Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Sales of foreclosed homes are up, and there can be some good deals that aren't money pits.
When you can buy something that's just about living ready for $75,000, that's a great place in a good neighborhood. You really can't ask for much more than that.
We'll have a checklist for how to buy a foreclosed property. For the recently unemployed, the checklist includes browsing the meager job postings and sending out resumes, and then what?
Gosh, it's a great feeling. It is like being on vacation some days. Like, what do I want to do today?
Yes, Virginia, there is an upside to our downturn. And stay tuned later for a live real estate auction right here in the studio.
And I will bid $10.
I will bid
$20. $30.
$50.
$90.
$100.
You can have it.
That would be me bidding for Tennessee Avenue with Monopoly money. See how this chump does against a board game champ. That story and more on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Springtime usually marks the start of open house season. It's a good time for maximum curb appeal, what with the leaves on the trees, the flowers in the garden. But who's selling this year, in this economy? The banks. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
Just when you thought the housing crisis couldn't get worse, the San Francisco Chronicle reported this week that banks are hiding what it called a shadow inventory of foreclosed homes. They're sitting on properties that could otherwise be sold. And once those houses do go on the market, property values could slip even further. Other banks are finding it's sometimes cheaper to pay homeowners off than to go to court over a foreclosure. Marketplace's Eve Troe took a look at who wins or loses on those deals.
Real estate broker Richard Allen used to sell homes in Canyon Country, California, just north of Los Angeles. Then the foreclosure tidal wave hit. Now he works for the other side.
My clients are the banks. They're selling the homes after they take them back through foreclosure.
The banks pay Richard to clear out the former owners. Evictions can cost banks thousands in legal fees and cleanup. So many have turned to a cheaper alternative. It's called cash for keys, and it's just what it sounds like. Former owners agree to leave by a certain date, and the bank gives them some money for good behavior. Today, Richard's meeting a young man named Hector for the first time.
Hector? Nice to meet you.
And probably the last, Richard's here to get the keys to Hector's condo.
I mean, everything works, heat works. Did you guys have any problems with cockroaches or anything?
No.
About 5 minutes later...
That's the mail key and then the house keys.
Okay, then I've got your check.
The check from the bank is made out to Hector for $2,000. He's going to live with friends in L.A. He seems okay about all this.
I mean, the only way to think about it is I get a fresh start again.
Hector's 25, bought the condo 4 years ago with a so-called balloon mortgage. After 2 years, his payments went up by $500 a month. He couldn't afford the increase, even with roommates. The bank foreclosed and assigned Richard Allen to deal with Hector and the property. Richard laid out the options, eviction or cash for keys. Hector took the cash.
If I would have said no, we probably would have stayed here, maybe another month?
Then Richard worked out how much he'd get. It's usually about 1% of what the bank thinks the home's new sale price will be. Dan Sinclair lives in Patterson, California. He was on this show about a year ago. He'd stopped paying his mortgage, couldn't afford it, but was still living in his house with his wife and 3 kids. When foreclosure began, Fannie Mae offered the family $2,500 if they were out in 30 days and left the place clean. Sinclair says the offer calmed him down.
You know, it's not your property anymore. You want to leave them with a pile of dung, like what you feel like they handed you, so to speak. And so that little bit of incentive kind of removes the temptation to do what we know we shouldn't do anyway.
Dan Sinclair thinks about the concrete patio he put in and the surround sound speakers still in the walls, investments left behind. The family owed about $500,000 on the house. It sold at auction back to Fannie Mae for about $180,000. Now the Sinclairs live in an apartment about a quarter mile away.
We drive by our old house all the time, and we miss it.
The house is sitting there, empty, no buyers. On its face, cash for keys is a game where everyone wins. The bank gets a clean, empty property. The former owners get money to move on. But dig a little deeper and...
everybody loses.
That's Richard Allen again, the real estate broker in Canyon Country. He says, look at Hector's case. The condo will be on the market in about a month, and it'll be priced to move.
It's going to be sold for significantly less than what he bought it for.
Would it sell for something that maybe Hector could have even have afforded at some point?
I would believe so.
But Hector's credit is shot. He can't buy anything anytime soon. And Dan Sinclair's old house is now a bargain, but his credit's ruined too. Meantime, the banks aren't making any money while the properties sit vacant. Zoe Cronin is a lawyer over on the East Coast with Greater Boston Legal Services. She says displacing people and leaving empty properties doesn't make social or economic sense.
I think the banks believe that they can only market the property vacant. But you have to take a closer look at that. Is that really a model that's a 20th century model and doesn't apply to the current situation?
She says owners in foreclosure may not be able to afford their mortgage, but most of them can pay something less. Her group is working with nonprofits that could buy properties from banks and keep former owners in their homes as tenants. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace Money.
Unfortunately, for a lot of folks, renting the home that they used to own is not an option, despite the fact that banks might benefit. But if you're in a buying mood, thousands of foreclosed homes are just waiting for you to come and take a look-see. Adam Allington reports from St. Louis.
Matt Kastner is a real estate broker in St. Louis. His primary business is foreclosed properties. And one thing he's gotten really good at in the past year is lowballing banks. Take this bank-owned condo that we're in now. It's 2,000 square feet, new floors, kitchen, bath. The original listing price last year was $125,000. But now...
early this year, it was down to 69. That listing expired. The fact that it hasn't sold at 69 already and it's been over a month, you probably could get this thing for $55,000.
But Kastner says the real steals don't last long, and the days of overnight pre-approval for a mortgage are well behind us. He says the most important thing is to have your financing already lined up.
The loan process right now is definitely more time-consuming than it was before, so if you don't have your homework done already, you're probably not going to get that property.
A few years back, if you were interested in buying a foreclosure, that usually meant buying as is, and don't even bother trying to haggle with the bank over that leaky roof or closing costs. But now that's starting to change.
Well, I can tell you for Wells Fargo, we do a lot of negotiating.
Jess Tirado handles the reselling of foreclosures for Wells Fargo. These days, many people looking to buy are financed with loans from the Federal Housing Administration. Those loans often come with conditions, like the property has to be livable, no sketchy wiring or bad plumbing. Tirado says that means in order to move foreclosures off their books, banks are having to behave like traditional sellers.
It is not uncommon at all for us to pay a certain amount of closing costs. Even, you know, once an inspection is done, they find other things that need to be repaired. We do that quite a bit.
Neil Gelman just bought what he says is his dream home, a two-story arts and crafts style townhouse that was in foreclosure.
How are you?
Hey, Neil.
This cul-de-sac was built in the 1920s.
Gelman had been looking for an affordable home in the affluent St. Louis suburb of Clayton for years. He got this property for $100,000 below its original list price. But it's not all money in his pocket.
The house was just a mess. You know, I have one dumpster here. The bank had at least two dumpsters prior.
The advantage of buying a foreclosure is that you can get the property at a discount and have cash left over to fix any problems. But there's also the temptation to focus on the sale price and underestimate the cost of repairs, which Gelman says can come back to bite you.
Municipalities do have inspections. They do have occupancy permits for resale, etc.
And unfortunately for the do-it-yourselfers among us, that often means hiring professionals.
You don't want to get yourself in a situation where you can't afford to pay contractors to do the work because it's going to catch you on resale.
Catching a falling knife is the analogy often used to describe investing in real estate these days. But at the end of the day, broker Matt Kastner says if you're looking to build long-term equity and can lock in an affordable interest rate, you could do a lot worse.
When you can buy something that's just about living ready for $75,000, that's a great place in a good neighborhood, you really can't ask for much more than that.
Kastner says above all else, people need to get inspections. Building, termite, sewer, at least. Know what you're working with before buying. because for the first time in a long, long while, buyers are able to drive a hard bargain, and many sellers, banks included, are willing to take that offer. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by the Henry Luce Foundation, seeking to increase American understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Time for the audio op-ed. We call The Straight Story, and joining me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Chris, how you feeling these days?
I'm feeling pretty good. How about you?
You know, I watch Wall Street, and I think, maybe it's time.
Starting to see some of those Ben Bernanke green shoots. I mean, you're a gardener, right?
Yes. I think the herbs are coming up in my garden, as well as perhaps the stock market.
Of course, this is all getting me a little bit concerned.
Uh-oh.
This discussion about, you know, was the best 4 weeks since 1933, perhaps we hit bottom, it's just starting to make me nervous.
But you look at the pure numbers and the market is up more than what, 20, 25% in 4 weeks?
Yeah, that's right. Here's the thing. I'm actually in the camp that thinks maybe this is a real rally. I mean, I expect some bad days, some bad weeks, but maybe we are starting to see a little bit of the bottom, but let's say we're wrong. I'm hoping for a lot of reasons that our 201ks become 401ks, all those types of things, and people not losing their jobs, that this is for real. But for the individual investor, for managing your money, it is absolutely the wrong way to look at the market.
And I suppose what you're getting at is the lesson that when you're watching what's going on the stock market, what happens from day to day, week to week, month to month, even year to year, should not affect your actions.
That's right. So I want to argue for a kind of market timing.
You're arguing for market timing?
I'm for a certain kind of market timing. Now, let's say your portfolio has been ravaged and you got some bills coming due.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a little bit of a rally in the market. Don't be greedy. Take a look at your bills. What's coming due? How fragile is your balance sheet? 3 months ago, how nervous were you?
Mm-hmm.
And then opportunistically, if the market goes your way and you can do a little bit of shuffling in your portfolio, maybe sell some stock, maybe get out of a higher risk area, go more conservative, make those kinds of adjustments in your portfolio and follow the market, like you say, Tess, because it does give us indications of what's going on, but try not to get into the greed and fear business.
Yeah. You know, what about those folks who maybe 3 months ago, 5 months ago, swore they were never going to own stocks again? And now they're looking at what's going on and they're thinking, maybe it's time to get back in.
And I've been talking to personal financial planners, people in the business, and that's exactly their experience. The client that said, I'm not going to trust corporate America again. Well, mm-hmm. Warren Buffett says it's okay. Jim Cramer says it's okay.
Uh-oh.
Maybe it's time to get back into the market. You just don't want to go that route. You just want to look at your own life, your children's lives, your spouse's life. What are the bills coming due? What are you trying to accomplish? And stay focused on that.
The Straight Story from our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And we'll check back later in the show with some getting personal.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
It's amazing how much you can do on the web these days. Program your TiVo, Twitter with Demi Moore and Shaquille O'Neal. See the results of your MRI. Yeah, online health records. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. You go online to buy books, to read the news, even to order pizza. Well, now patients at New York Presbyterian may also be able to see the results of their latest blood test. The hospital is the first major institution to offer patients their own digital health records. The program started this week. Sally Herships conducted a checkup to find out if the new system might ultimately tamp down on healthcare costs.
Patrice Cohen is wearing sparkly earrings and a low-cut V-neck. She looks pretty good, especially for someone who just had her sternum cracked open. Cohen had open-heart surgery just a couple months ago. Serious stuff. But the scar from her operation is smaller than her pile of medical records.
I saw the file one day, and I actually had to make a joke. Am I really that sick? It's about, 8 inches high.
Cohen is 50. She lives in New Jersey. She has some other conditions, too, and a lot of doctors.
Cardiologist. I have a nephrologist. I have a rheumatologist. And then I have my GP. And, of course, I guess my gynecologist.
The doctors at the hospital where Cohen had her surgery, New York Presbyterian, are trying something new. Instead of paper, they're offering digital records. Cohen can now access her files online. She says if the country's whole healthcare system went digital, patients like her wouldn't need to waste their time with duplicate paperwork.
You go to a new doctor, you fill out all these new forms. What medication do you take? What allergies do you have? What surgeries have you had? When have you had them?
In the meantime, she says, her doctors are glad they no longer have to be pen pals. Waiting for reports to be faxed and mailed can cause delays. Instead, she says, she logs onto her account and prints out whatever they need. Ashley Katz is executive director of the nonprofit organization Patient Privacy Rights. Katz says while there may be benefits to health information technology, there are risks too.
So people can do really good things with that information, and then they can also do really bad things.
Katz says without strong privacy protections in place, employers and insurers may be able to see private data. Say someone is taking medication that's expensive or for an embarrassing condition.
So say they're taking an antidepressant or an anti-anxiety medication or something for a sexually transmitted disease.
Medical information, Katz says, can easily influence what employers and insurers think. A person's abilities and costs can be evaluated, all based on their private medical history. But heart patient Patrice Cohen isn't worried about digital records.
One day I went with my whole thick paper file to one of my doctors and I left without it. First of all, I had to figure out where I left it.
She got her files back. And now she says she feels much safer knowing her hospital records are online. N. Cohen says while getting stuck with needles doesn't bother her anymore, getting the same procedure twice does. It can be expensive. Recently, she had an EKG. A couple days later, she saw her cardiologist. He also wanted to test her heart.
And I said, oh, I just had one done 2 days ago. So he said, okay, then we don't have to do it. Called the GP's office, and that was the day he was off.
Those doctors aren't part of New York Presbyterian's system. Their records aren't online. So she had to do the test again. Richard Hillestad is a researcher at the nonprofit RAND Corporation. He agrees digitizing health records will save money. But right now, he says, most of those savings will go into the pocket of insurers.
Ultimately, you would hope that those savings to insurers would be passed on down and to reduce healthcare costs for individuals.
Hillestad says if it were to go completely digital, the country's healthcare system could save $80 billion. Patrice Cohen has to have her heart surgery again in 15 years. But, she says, in medical science, that's light years away. Next time she hopes she'll be able to take a pill instead of having an operation. And, she says, by then, all of her medical records should be online. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
The employment picture has been getting more grim with each passing month. The unemployment rate now stands at 8.5%. Repercussions are everywhere, foreclosed homes, mounting debt. But there is another side to the story. People with large savings accounts or whose pink slips came with severance packages. Many of them are young and single, and for them, unemployment is a chance to, yes, live it up a bit. Julie Rose of member station WFAE in Charlotte found some of them.
The subject line of the email read, "Laid off," all caps, 2 exclamation points. It was from my friend, Jenny Vanstone, an interior designer. I felt terrible thinking of her down in the unemployment line. But a few weeks later, I started getting emails from her that were like, "Hey, can't right now, off to meet a friend for coffee," or "Headed to the park, we'll talk later."
As long as I get my resumes out, I make a little bit of an effort to look for work. Gosh, it's a great feeling. It is like being on vacation some days. Like, what do I want to do today?
Tell you what I'd like to do is get home from work just once this week before the sun sets. And I know this sounds awful, but I'm jealous of Jenny. She's doing more yoga, taking road trips, and her social life is booming.
I can stay out later at night because I can take a nap the next day if I am worn out. Now I have flexibility.
You could say flexibility and freedom are the upside of being laid off, if there is an upside. But the unemployment grass isn't always as green as it seems. I meet Yaqui Benson at an after-hours mixer for people who've been pink-slipped. She's been out of work for 2 months.
I do take time out and go to the movies. I'll go volunteer. I'll go and visit with friends. It keeps me from focusing so hard on the fact that I don't have a job, because it can be depressing.
Nonprofits say they're getting lots of calls from unemployed people with extra time on their hands. Jeff Steiner started volunteering too, since he was laid off from a Charlotte law firm in August. He says he is not treating unemployment like a party, but he knows people who are.
People who haven't done a thing, literally since August, that will go out drinking 7 nights a week till 2 a.m. every night. You know, I mean, it's dumb.
Maybe he's not out drinking every night, but Jeff's also not exactly hurting. With a nice severance package, he has the luxury of taking a little time to decide what comes next.
You know, getting a job at a large top 50 law firm these days, absolute disaster. So you got to use this time to either reinvent your career path, or you can say, all right, let me tread water doing something that I hate and hope that in 2 years there's a position waiting for me.
That's how Jenny is taking things too, especially since interior design jobs are hard to come by.
It's about not jumping onto the first thing available. It's about finding the right thing for me. I definitely feel like there's been a huge silver lining, and I'm looking at it as an opportunity more than a crisis.
Jenny's fortunate that losing her job didn't plunge her into immediate crisis, and she knows it. But she's going on 4 months without work now. The unemployment checks will soon stop coming, and her savings will eventually run out. So she's given me permission to envy her free time, as long as I remember that it comes with a price. In Charlotte, North Carolina, I'm Julie Rose for Marketplace Money.
By the way, one of Julie's sources, Yaqui Benson, got some good news recently. She was hired for a temp job at a local bank.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
It's that time of the show when we answer your personal finance questions. And joining me once again is our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. And Chris, you may remember last week, and I believe the week before, we talked to a couple of callers who were moving from Boston to Los Angeles.
Oh, yes. And you had fond memories of Boston.
I did. But I then also invited our listeners to write in if they were moving perhaps from Los Angeles to Boston. And we heard from Bonnie here in Los Angeles, California. She and her husband have a pretty healthy retirement. They've saved about $100,000, and they're hoping that it's going to help with a down payment on a home when they move to Boston.
Okay.
But they're a little worried about finding jobs and are wondering if there's some sort of website that might give them a lay of the land job market-wise in Boston.
Well, there's a couple things you can do. I guess one of the easiest things to do is you go to one of the job websites, tests like monster.com, mm-hmm. and you can narrow your search down to the Boston area. So you can do that, get a little bit of information. The Federal Reserve Bank of Boston has a wonderful website, and you can get a good sense of what's been happening in the job market. They come out with this monthly report called the Beige Book. And, you know, Beige Book's pretty detailed on what's going on. And, of course, part of their reading before they move, boy, I'd be reading the Boston Globe regularly to see what's happening in the Boston market.
Well, that assumes that the Boston Globe is still there for some time to come.
Well, it's still there for now. It's still there for now. I checked.
And you could also try the Boston Herald as well. So it really sounds like these websites are the place to go. And I think there are some also that would give them some idea of cost of living and that sort of thing in a different city.
That's right. There's just a whole host of websites. They're sort of rules of thumb. You type in some numbers. They're all tied into moving, and they will give you an idea about cost of living. But if you're going to make a move like this, I would invest some money making some trips out there. There is no substitute for talking to people. Set up some interviews, even if they're just informational, and make some trips with a real estate agent. Because, you know, Tess, when you type in these numbers about standard of living, Los Angeles versus Boston, you get one set of information. But when you're actually looking at the neighborhoods and the kind of house you might buy, you know, you get a real sense of, okay, this is what it is. This is what my life would be like. So invest in a couple of trips out there.
Okay. Sounds like a good plan to me. Bonnie, thanks for writing in. And I'll give you one restaurant recommendation. Try Matt Murphy's in Brookline. It's one of my favorite places, and I miss it a lot. So say hi to him there for me. All right, let's go to the phones. And Amanda is on the line from Aurora, Colorado. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Tess.
What's your question for Chris today?
Well, I am trying to refinance my home. I have a VA mortgage, have great credit. You know, what I do is I go to bankrate.com. I look at all these places and the interest rates they're offering and the APR. I get back these good faith estimates, and there's all these strange fees that I don't understand. It's like going and buying a car, and then suddenly there's all these extra charges. So I'm not sure what fees I should expect and what fees are reasonable.
Yeah, Chris, you know, I think the good faith estimate is just the wrong name for this piece of paper that you get when you get a mortgage or when you refinance. There is no good faith behind these numbers whatsoever, I can tell you from personal experience.
From a lot of people, it's the what? Hook the fish?
Right.
Estimate. And this is how I like to shop around. I'll just give you the way that I do it. Go to your local credit union if they make VA loans, or go back to your original lender. And you say, here's what I'm going to do. I want to refinance my VA loan, and it's really cheap on you to do. So what's the deal here? And then I think you'll get a pretty good faith estimate at that point, as opposed to going to Bankrate and trying to find the mortgage brokers that are offering the cheaper rate, because they're probably making their money off the fees.
But Chris, when she asks kind of, you know, what fees should you be expected to pay, it's so hard to tell which of them are valid and which ones are not. And I've actually been in the position of challenging some of these fees. As long as you notice it, you can say, wait a minute, what's with that one there? And they're like, oh, yeah, you don't need to pay that one. You know, $400 for faxing.
My favorite fee on the recent good faith estimate that I received, they said there's no appraisal fee, and they have that marked on here clearly. And then you scroll to the bottom, it says pest inspection, $100 fee.
Oh, good grief.
How are you going to inspect for pests if you're not coming to my home?
How do you know which ones are valid and which ones aren't?
You simply have to go through every single fee, and that's why you shop around. There is no shortcut here, Tess. You have to be your own advocate. You can go to a service like HSH.com, and what they'll do is provide a computer printout in your area and what the closing costs are going to be, and at least you can do some initial shopping so that you're armed with that, and then when you actually approach the lender, you have some information there. Because what they're playing on is that you have a lack of information, and you're only focused on that interest rate.
And Amanda, I guess my final piece of advice to you would be, don't be afraid to ask about these fees. I think sometimes it can be intimidating to walk in there. You see this massive stack of papers and you see this good faith estimate, and you're like, oh, okay. Don't do that. Ask the questions. You're in charge.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Amanda, thanks so much for the call, and good luck with the refi. Well, if you've got some questions that need clarification, do visit our website. We're at marketplace.org. Click on the Getting Personal link there. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. For those of you who still need a reminder, and you know who you are, Wednesday is tax day. Grumble all you want about Uncle Sam and his grubby little hands and all those people inside the IRS whose job it is to make your life miserable. Of course, that's not true. And on this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet someone within those walls whose job is quite the opposite.
This message from the National Taxpayer Advocate is intended for all taxpayers.
My name is Nina Olson, and I am the National Taxpayer Advocate of the IRS.
Service. As an independent organization within the IRS, we help taxpayers.
The short description of what my job is to be the voice of the taxpayer inside the IRS. I think people are afraid of the IRS, and not without good reason, but, you know, people need to be very careful about what they do. They can't hide their head in the sand and think that if they've gotten a letter from the IRS, it will go away. That's why Congress created the Taxpayer Advocate Service, so that people who either were experiencing real economic harm or had been trying to resolve things with the IRS, and either the IRS wasn't listening or they couldn't find the right person, you know, then they can come to the Taxpayer Advocate Service and there will be someone there to help them. I am appointed in this position by the Secretary of the Treasury. There's no term, so I was appointed by Secretary Summers in 2001, and here I still am. When I'm in public, for example, when I'm on airplanes and you start up a conversation and people say, where do you work? Normally start out by saying, I work in the federal government. And then they say, well, where in the federal government? And I say, I work in the Department of Treasury. And they say, well, what do you do in the Department of Treasury? What agency? And I say, the IRS. And immediately there's this pause. And then, you know, the brave ones say, well, what do you do in the IRS? And that's when I say I'm the National Taxpayer Advocate. And that often starts a whole conversation about people's tax problems, which is actually not a good thing to do when you're sitting on an airplane and everybody around you is listening intently.
Good morning, Taxpayer Advocacy Service.
Okay, so here's the thing about these consumer tax tip brochures.
I spend most of my day fussing at people. I fuss at my employees so that they advocate better. Then sometimes I'm fussing at the rest of the IRS. In many ways, it can be about a case, it can be about a program, it can be about something that they're thinking about doing or not thinking about doing. And, you know, I'm certainly not just fussing, I'm making my case for why they should do it. This year I make about $172,000 a year, and I do have an opportunity to get a bonus, I guess, if I'm a good National Taxpayer Advocate. I think people are always surprised to find out that there's someone inside the IRS that does the work that I do, and they're just really surprised that there's somebody there acknowledging, you know, the warts and all on the IRS, and also being constantly hopeful about the fact that problems can be solved.
That was our tax advocate, Nina Olson, who, by the way, says she finished her taxes last month. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Rebecca Martinez. You don't have a choice but to tell the IRS all about your financial life, but how comfortable are you talking money with your spouse?
Money has always been this sort of last great taboo in American culture.
Marriage, money, and a brutal game of Monopoly. Next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
We'll be right back.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. For 6 years, Wall Street Journal columnist Jeff Opdyke wrote a column about his financial life and his wife's. It was called Love and Money, and they worked out their money issues right there in public. Now he's got a book, Financially Ever After, about the lessons he learned from that experience. Welcome to the program, Jeff. And I have to ask you, how many couples do you think actually talk about money before they're married?
Somewhere between 0 and 2.
Yeah, there you go.
It's much easier for people to talk about sex these days than it is to talk about money. And it's because money has always been this sort of last great taboo in American culture. You know, you're not supposed to tell your neighbors how much you earn, and you never saw mom and dad talking about money. You know, if there was a money issue in the family, it was usually mom and dad worried about money somehow. And when we get married, nobody's thinking that money's going to be an issue for us. You know, you know there's going to be fights in a relationship, but it's going to be over how do we raise the kids or what school do they go to or religion or whatever. Nobody thinks it's going to be money. And when you get married, it turns out you end up, you know, at sort of each other's throats over who spent $25 last week on cafe lattes on the credit card.
You talk in the book about how important it is to have these discussions really early on. How do you go about figuring out what your future life partner understands in terms of the basics of finance?
You act like a private investigator. Mm-hmm. I mean that sort of half jokingly, but it's also true. Some of it's going to come through just normal conversations. I mean, you're going to hear how your future partner is through what he or she says about whining about the credit card coming in again and not having enough to pay it off. You know, if you see that happening again and again and again and again, you recognize that this person has sort of an addiction to their credit card and they are living a lifestyle on the back of American Express that they can't afford themselves. But the PI part of it comes in through paying attention to the mail that comes through the house. Do you see a lot of credit card statements coming in, or do you see them intermixed with statements from Fidelity and Vanguard and Charles Schwab that show that this person has some sort of, you know, investment account somewhere? As it gets closer to this becoming a permanent relationship or moving towards marriage or engaged, whatever, you want to start having the real conversations at that point. What's your idea of retirement?
That's very romantic, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's not the most romantic. Honest to God, it really is not the most romantic conversation you're going to have. But, I mean, how much of a disaster is it going to be if you've never really had a financial conversation with your spouse ever and you're approaching retirement and you sit down one day and you say, honey, I can't wait for retirement because I'm so looking forward to moving to that apple orchard in Wisconsin. And your spouse looks at you and said, apple orchard in Wisconsin? I was going to buy a condo in Hawaii. There's no way in hell I'm going to live out in Wisconsin. You know, I mean, that's the disaster right there.
It seems like that conversation must have changed quite a bit over the years. I mean, now you have women who may have been working and independent for years before getting married, both partners perhaps getting married later, which means they've got all kinds of established spending and savings habits. It's certainly not like it was, say, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, there's so many answers here, and there's so many sort of paths you could follow with this, but I'll start by noting that, yes, people are getting married later in life, and because of that, you're coming into relationships with far more financial baggage, good baggage and bad baggage. Now, it also raises a topic which I tend to be on the sort of outer fringes of, and that is the idea of women coming into relationships. They've been on their own for years. They get married. They want to keep their own checking accounts and their own savings accounts, and you, my husband, you keep your own checking account and your own savings account, and we'll create this little third joint account in the middle, mm-hmm. and that'll pay for all the household debts and everything. And I understand the reason for doing that, but I disagree with it completely because I think it is you're going into the marriage with preconceived notions or at least the idea somewhere tucked in the back of your head that this relationship just might fail and therefore I need to prepare myself financially for that. Personally, I think the best thing that couples can do when they get married is to merge their finances because it creates financial honesty.
And a lot less paperwork, I would say. And
much less paperwork.
Jeff, I was a huge fan of your column in the Wall Street Journal, Love and Money, because you really opened up your life and kind of splayed it out there for everyone to see. Arguments with your wife, Amy, over various money issues. Eventually, you even did videos where you and she kind of debated. And I have to say, she didn't always look pleased.
she wasn't always pleased, I promise you.
What was that like to put all that out there? And how on earth did you convince her this was a worthwhile exercise?
I'm going to take the second part of that first.
Okay.
How did I convince her of that? You know, I got a call from my editor, and he basically said, look, I want to start this column about couples and what really goes on in everyday family finance. And I'm asking you to do it because you're the only idiot I know who would open up his life and do that. And I was like, well, you know, I guess that's a compliment. I sat down with Amy and I told her what the opportunity was, and she jumped at it immediately. And it's because of everything that you and I have just been talking about. She recognized early on in her infinite wisdom that this would be a fantastic way for she and I to communicate better about money. She didn't know how to talk to me about them. I didn't think she was that interested, honestly. So in the middle, there was a giant chasm. And so the greatest thing that has come out of 6 years of writing this is that it has actually made my wife and I closer than we ever were.
Jeff Opdyke wrote the Wall Street Journal's Love and Money column for 6 years, and he is now the author of Financially Ever After, The Couple's Guide to Managing Money. Thanks so much for your time.
Hey, I've had fun. Thanks.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
It's time for more Getting Personal, and I'm here once again with our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, let's start with a caller. Christopher is on the line in Oakland, California. Hi there, Christopher.
Hello, Tess.
So how can we help you today?
Well, I had a question about what age is it that children can really grasp finances and managing money?
Do you have some kids that you're hoping to educate?
Yes. I'm actually a ghostwriter by trade, and I'm starting to do some research for my own book. And the idea came to me. I have a grandson in New York that's just 5 and a half, and his aunt took him to the toy store and bought him a toy. And when he came back, his parents wanted him to thank his aunt, but he didn't see why he should do that. He bought the toy. So it poses the question, where does money come from?
Yes, absolutely.
Actually, we asked him that one, and he said that, well, people make it. People go to work, and people give them money, and they make it by cutting out bits of paper and stamping on it what it looks like, and or making quarters or something.
So, Chris, I guess the question here is, at what age does a book on finances really do any good?
Well, depending on the book, there's sort of like three stages. One is around the age of 6, 7. And then there's sort of the 9, 10, 11. That's when Warren Buffett got interested in stocks. And then there's your teenager. And they seem to be sort of like your three categories that I would just quickly divide things into. But the notion of, say, buying a stock at age 6 or credit card debt, these are pretty hard concepts. And I would be steering clear of them for that age group. But you could have a lot of fun with work, chores, allowance, all of which is part of the how money influences a family.
So do you think that this is the age of your grandson that you might want to target?
I think that's where the most fun is.
Yes.
I think for scenarios, and it's that area where magic sort of happens and money does just come out of the ATM machine, but then trying to sort of carefully create some kind of a dreadful word, accountability.
Well, 6-year-olds aren't the only ones who need to learn accountability these days, are they?
Bernie Madoff, Sir Alan Stanford, yes.
The nation's bankers, perhaps?
Yes.
Well, they could all perhaps benefit from this book. What do you
say? Exactly. Exactly. So does that help you out a little bit?
Yes, I think the three stages does make sense. And I think perhaps even that sounds like three books.
As he ages. One around age 6, one around age 9, and then one around age 13.
Yes.
Well, be sure to send them to us when you're done with them.
Okay, will do. Thank you so much.
Well, Chris, next we have an email. Margaret in Alexandria, Virginia wrote in, and she recently rebalanced her portfolio and dropped a mutual fund that had TIPS in it. This is Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. And her advisor said that because her allocation is 70% stocks, 30% bonds, she's already protected against inflation by being invested in the stock market. I'm not sure how that's possible. Do you agree with this reasoning, that if you're in stocks, you're already protected against inflation?
I don't agree with the reasoning, and there's two reasons why I don't. One just has to do with pure risk. When you're in TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, it's a security designed to protect you against inflation, plus there's no default risk.
You can't lose your money.
It's an obligation of the U.S. government. Now, when you go to stocks, there's always a risk that, whoever thought that GM would be a blue chip penny stock? I mean, you know, so right. There's always risk there.
Or Citigroup.
So there's more risk on the inflation front. It depends how high inflation is. Above 3%, and what people are afraid of is a really high and rising rate of inflation because of everything that the Fed's doing, and it's printing money.
Right.
That's not a good environment for stocks. It just isn't. Some parts of the stock market will benefit from that environment, right? Because an inflationary environment helps certain kinds of companies. But overall, for the stock market, high inflation depresses earnings. Earnings are the fundamental basis behind stock valuation. So I'm a little bit skeptical of this argument.
So you would advise that she should go back into TIPS?
I like TIPS. I just think TIPS are a wonderful way to have a risk-free portion of your portfolio.
Well, if you like TIPS, the kind that Chris gives you, not necessarily the kind from the government, do give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. The Getting Personal link is at marketplace.org. And Chris is answering some questions on his blog over there, too. So check it out. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
You're welcome, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So I was having dinner recently with a cousin and his friend here in Los Angeles, and his friend casually mentioned that he was going to the National Monopoly Championships in Washington, D.C. this week as a player. I thought, Monopoly? The game about the buying and selling of property? The game about banking and taxes and mortgages and a little bailout plan called Pass Go and Collect $200? Now that's a game for our times. Want to play?
This is just the vintage edition that I like to play with. It's a number 9 from about 1952.
Brian Bowles is that friend of my cousin's.
What I like most about it is it has wood houses and hotels, as opposed to the newer editions that have the plastic ones. These have a little more weight and feel to them.
Bowles is 25 years old, lives in L.A., and brought two vintage Monopoly boards to our studios from his collection of about 300.
Yeah. Top hat.
The race car, some of the most
popular.
Do
we think this is an American-made car? Should I use that while we're playing, just in support of Detroit?
It's good.
He suggested we roll the dice to see who got what token. He won, and he chose the car. Bowles is one of 28 players who will compete in the national tournament on Tuesday and Wednesday. As he used me for target practice, I asked what drew him to this particular game.
The earliest memory I have of playing is sitting around with my dad and my cousins and them teaching me all the ways of the game. I think eventually at some point it was because they wanted to be able to teach me a lesson on how to get beat at board games, which now I'm giving them lessons on how to get beat.
Right.
So it's worked out nicely in my favor.
I'll start off. 6. I will purchase Oriental Avenue for $100.
Bowles wasn't quite biting on my stretch of an idea that the game is somehow relevant to our current real estate crisis, with one exception.
People have always commented on how the properties have never actually changed in value since 1935 when the game started. So everybody says, $400 for Boardwalk, that's a bargain these days. And you think, yeah, you're right, you probably can't.
It's true. Property values are down in Atlantic City, some 10%, since the start of 2008, though, not 1935.
St. Charles Place. I will buy St. Charles Place for $140. Okay.
Yeah, excellent choice to purchase.
Thank you.
Because St. Charles is one of the cards that has a chance card that says advance to St. Charles Place.
More rent payments for me to collect. Speaking of chance, I decided to take one with another Monopoly man. Phil Orbanes is a former Parker Brothers executive. He wrote the definitive history of the game in his book, Monopoly, the world's most famous game and how it got that way. And he says there are plenty of lessons to learn as you make your way around the board, especially when it comes to real estate.
It's not just a matter of excitingly going and buying things for the sake of buying, but knowing where to put your money to protect you, you know, or to reinforce the opportunity for you to reach your goal.
And at least we're not looking at any kind of funky mortgages in this game. No arms, right?
No, if anything, this game teaches that while mortgaging is essential at times, that it is to be avoided if you can do so.
Tennessee Avenue. I don't want it, so I'll say let it go up for auction, and I will bid $10.
I will bid $20.
$30.
$50.
$90.
$100.
You can have it.
Okay. Oh, except I only have $60.
Yep.
So what do I do?
You're going to have to mortgage something.
Well, let's see. So I have to get, what can I mortgage for $40?
So multiple lessons here. Don't go and buy things just for the sake of buying, as Orbanes said. Always know how much money you have in the bank. And don't mortgage a utility, as I was getting ready to do, if you already own both. There's some kind of strategy there. We had to end our game before it was over, you know, go back to work. But turns out I did just fine.
Okay. Oh, I'm very colorful over here.
See, you already own 5 different colored properties. Now all you need is a green, a red, and a dark purple, and mm-hmm. then you'll have what's called a rainbow monopoly.
And I'm sure that's exactly what would have happened. By the way, the winner this week will get $20,580 in prize money, a real version of the amount available in a Monopoly game. They'll also go to the World Championships in Vegas in October. Check our website later this week to find out how Brian does. And while you're there, you can peruse some photos of our Monopoly match. And that's Marketplace Monopoly Money for this week. Next time, is your credit score something to gloat about?
792.
792?
Mm-hmm.
I beat you.
It's because you're 10 years younger than me and you haven't had the chance to make any mistakes.
We'll take an hour-long look at our relationship with credit. Marketplace Money's producers include Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troe, with help this week from Doug Krisner. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the Internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
American Public Media.